Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
No, I'm good today. Okay. I have a question on transference. Sorry, it's a bit long. My sister has a transference on me as her mother. She wants unconditional love from me and providing her with what she desires. I want to make up for the motherly love for her, which was maybe absent in some of her childhood. For years, she will take whatever she likes from me or ask me to give her financial support. Since very young, I've tried to give her or help her in whatever way was within my ability. After today's class, I asked myself, was how I responded to her in all these years kind of maybe lack of healthy boundaries? How do we define that healthy boundary? And how to know what is really healing for the people we try to help, especially those who lack motherly love, in terms of how much we give and how we give wisdom. You know, these kind of family relationships where a member of the family has a serious problem. It's not emotionally well, you know. Part of the problem that we have in trying to care for one of our siblings that has this kind of difficult problem is it's so painful. And their pain goes so deeply inside of you. And then it's very hard to handle also kind of their anger or their devastation when you don't give them everything that they want, you know, because they feel that they need it so badly and they have nowhere else to turn. So it's a really, really hard. And you have to set boundaries also, because a lot of these people who, sisters, brothers, or in your clients, or they themselves don't have the boundaries, and that makes it really hard too. Because then the boundary issue is totally on you, because they're not able to, just not able to do that. And maybe you think they should be able to, but the fact is they probably really are not able to do it. And that means that's another thing you have to do, and that's another thing that's really hard and painful. And they're your sister or brother. So, I guess in this type of situation, I've had some similar situations in my life. Not the same, but, you know, I can relate to that. I have followed Swamiji's lead in this. I'll tell you what he does. When, at the Coimbatore Ashram, and I've also been to Manjikudi, where he grew up, So the Coimbatore ashram, between classes, Swamiji will sometimes come out and sit in the living room, and there's usually a long line of tribal families that live up in the hills around Coimbatore that really are desperately in need of one thing or another. Either they have to have money for their child to go to school, or somebody is sick, or there's some terrible thing, some calamity of some sort, something that needs immediate help is taking place. And and so sometimes it's quite a line, you know. And the people do really need. It's not like they need whatever it is. So privately, I asked him one time when he had just finished the lineup and I was seeing him talking about something, and I said, Swamiji, how do you handle this constant tremendous, you know, neediness and asking you for all of these things? What do you do? What do you do? How do you handle it? And he said, I give everything that I can, and when I can't, don't have it to give, then I have to say no. But I give what I can. And so I think that's a realistic answer, because the people are trusting in you, they need you, they might have psychological problems and they don't really have boundaries, but you're, in some instances, all they have. You're the only one that they trust enough or have that relationship where they will ask you. And so then I think it's a matter of giving what you can, you know, and, you know, setting boundaries. Because when you can't give something, then you can't give it. It doesn't mean like you're at all that you're rejecting the person, but there's the boundaries there, and I can't do that right now. And you say that because it's true, not because you're making it up, you know. And that's why he has that freedom to say, I'll do what I, he'll say things like, I'll do what I can, I can't help you right now. You know, if he can find a way, he will find a way. And that's that heart as big as Ishwara that we're all working toward. And so if we can find a way to help, we do. We have to set boundaries. I mean, if this sister was your child, you would certainly set boundaries for your child, or she would not have any security. Those boundaries, kind boundaries, are necessary. You know, and they have to live within those boundaries. If say their mother, or the one who they have the mother transference on, has no boundaries themselves, then there's nothing to really contain her, you know. But the thing is, you have to set enough. Learn, let me say, just speaking for myself, you have to learn how to kindly set boundaries without hurting the person. The person may get hurt anyway, but you're not frustrated and irritated and angry because you don't know how to handle this person, you know. And so then you want to push them away or escape. And that I found that type of response or reaction is because you don't know how to say no nicely or with love. And so we let it go on too long until we're so frustrated and so fed up and angry that it does become like a pushback. And so we have to realize that that's what happens to us if we don't, and not just, I mean, anybody, I think, if we don't set the boundaries and be able to say no where we really have to say no. But then, if you say it early on enough, you can say it with some love and some kindness, and think of some other way you may be able to help. Maybe you can't help fully, but maybe you can do something. You know, you have to figure out what you can do to help. And probably one of the biggest ways that we can help, which is in some senses one of the hardest ways, is that we have to give our time. That requires a lot of patience and the time that some people who have a deep pain inside, they require a lot of time. And so that also has to be, you have to have boundaries around that, and then you have to give what you can. The problem with this, that this is a lesson that Swamiji learned and actually talked about, is that it's not like you can give enough time. Like you think that, well, if I give even some more time, then that would be enough. It won't be enough. Any amount of time won't be enough because of the pain. You know. And so then what we have to do is give as much time as we can and say, I can give this amount of time. We can talk this time. I can be with you for 40 minutes. Or I can be with you for 20 minutes right now. So let's just really try to talk and make use of that time. And set that as a boundary. Say, okay, we'll have to talk again. Maybe tomorrow or next week we can talk or whatever. You set it and you keep to it. Like say you said 20 minutes or say you said a half an hour. Then you give the full half hour. Not 28 minutes or 29 minutes. You give the full half hour. And then you say, okay, we have to stop. But do what you say. And then make another, we can talk again. Or if you have to say that, maybe you don't have to say that. Maybe it's more, maybe that's not necessary. But maybe if you don't say something, then they'll call in another in the next hour. So then you have to say, let's talk again on, say today's Monday, let's talk again on Wednesday, or let's talk again on next Monday, or let's talk again at this time. So that you're not just slamming the door. If you have to set a time in order to set some boundaries, because they need to talk to you all of the time. You can even say if you want, if something's really on your mind, write it all down. Keep a journal and write everything down. And then next time we talk, the things that are important, you can tell me those things. It's kind of therapeutic, and you're not your sister's therapist, but you can use some of these things that I'm saying in your own way as the sister who's having to take care of her sibling because of these problems. It's very, very, very hard because it's so painful when one of your family members is in trouble like that and you're the one that they depend upon. And so you actually have to rise to the occasion as much as you can, or you will feel terrible. So it's not something that there's much choice in it, because the choice is to learn how to handle the situation in the best way that you can. You know, setting those boundaries in such a way that you can give to your sibling, and at the same time, the sibling also needs boundaries. Because when somebody's in a lot of pain, there are no boundaries, and there's no limit to the need. So you have to put boundaries around the need. So I mean, otherwise you won't be able to handle the situation. So these are the things Bhagavan gives us, these things. And then it's ours. It's not anybody else's. So there's nobody else you can kind of, it's yours. So yep. To understand fears better, does fear manifest in many forms? For example, insecurity, low self-esteem, seeking attention, even complaining. Fear is kind of the fundamental problem. That everything is, all of the ways that we, all of our anger or irritation or discomfort, or like say if you see needing, feeling a need for more attention, well, what is that about? It could be that you have to ask yourself when you feel all of these, by asking, what are you really afraid of? It could be something like, you know, I don't have anybody to really care about me. There's nobody there to really give me attention. Or something like that. There's a feeling of a not just a lack of attention, but a fear of not being able to get the attention. You know, or low self-esteem, I'm afraid nobody likes me. What's low self-esteem? You wouldn't have low self-esteem if you felt that people loved you and wanted you. So it's a fear of not being wanted or not being loved, you know. Even say somebody's is a difficult, really difficult person, then you have a fear that they may not go away and they'll stay in your life. And they're such a difficult person that it just makes mincemeat out of your life. If you know, so you're afraid of them. You're afraid of them because you haven't learned how to handle them in a way that you can keep your shanti. That's number one. So you're afraid. And number two, you haven't learned yet how to handle them. And then you also might feel, I don't ever want to have to handle them. You know, I want them to go away because they impinge so much on a nice life that I could have if they weren't around. That's another biggie, a big bug on. Time to drop this bomb on you. Because it is very threatening. It's very threatening because you don't know how to be with them in a way that doesn't really affect your well-being. And then there they are. You know, it may not. Bhagavan sets traps for us. There they are, with no end in sight for a change in the situation. You know. And so when that's the situation, no end in sight, you are the one that has to change, basically. So that's the, you know, kind of putting the noose on. And you have to deal then. And the other person is not going to be able to because of their own limitations and whatnot. Not capable to do that. So it's not something often that the two of you can work out together, you know. And because of the karma, for you to make them leave would be devastating for that person. And so it's on you then. So then you have to meditate. You know why I'm saying that? Just ask Bhagavan for help and grow. One thing that has... I have my own really love and admiration for some things I've learned actually from the Dalai Lama. One thing I really... he's had the most excruciating life. You know, losing Tibet and having so many of the monks, so many of his monks and people mercilessly slaughtered. It's inconceivable what he has gone through. And what the other monks, the monks have gone through also, because a lot of them have been imprisoned and beaten and killed, and you know. And but they have such a vow. They've taken such a, they have such a commitment, such a vow to never give back that in kind, to only give back love and compassion. That's the vow that they take very seriously. You know, one thing beautiful about the Buddhism is that it really is all about sadhana and practice. And that practice, the attitudinal practice especially, is what is responsible, and the non-clinging, giving up, acceptance, these type of things, there's several of them, but that is, that antakarana shuddhi, that practice where antakarana shuddhi is, the freedom is that. And the whole, even the, to be able to recognize that shunyata, it is only the recognition takes place because of your antakarana shuddhi, not because there's a teaching methodology that is making you recognize that, and then you can continue to work on your antakarana shuddhi. It is the antakarana shuddhi. The teaching methodology is that, you know, the 12 steps. Anyway, I can teach about that later. So anyway, the Dalai Lama, he meditates for 4 hours a day. You know, and I can just imagine, I know that just from things that he said, a lot of that is just to come into deep deep shanti toward all of the excruciating pain that has taken place in reference to Tibet, to their land, to the temples, to the people, to the monks, the tremendous incredible cruelty to have to witness it also, let alone be subject to it, and then how they had to escape from Tibet. There's just this so much there. But you know, he will, I'm sure, and I don't know him, so I'm just kind of being him for the moment, you know, with my own projection on my loving, very highly respectful projection that I have on him and who he is, that he would, with his sadhana, I think he just habitually meditates for 4 hours a day. That's part of his sadhana. But he would every day bring himself into that deep resolution where he can, his heart can be as, how we would say, heart as big as Ishvara, where there is no pushing away, there is no rejection, there is simply being from that loving place, being with what is. And so sometimes I think of him and what people have had to go through, you know, the type of things that people, the unimaginable things that people have gone through. And for somebody like him, all of the horror stories that have taken place, that, and there's so much more. If you've ever watched videos or read about his life, the things that have happened to them, you know, what it means to be able to have that shanti and give what you can. And so I think that for us, kind of contemplating on certain role models, like Swamiji is a huge role model for me, how he would handle things, I do that. And Dalai Lama is a big role model for me. I feel so much, he's just a role model. I just, because of his life and the way, what he does and how he resolves all of these things and then gives out what is good, I think that's how we have to handle the situations that are come our way. Some are quite simple, but some are zingers, you know, kind of overwhelming, very, very tough, and you feel like your heart is just in a vice grip, you know. But that's our situation. And so learning how to be with that, to release it, to release the vice grip that is there, being able to resolve your mind, that becomes that can be a daily sadhana. To bring yourself into that level of shanti for, maybe it takes 4 hours. It's only 4 hours. And I also remember, like, Swamiji in the last, you know, year of his life or so, how he made all of the students realize that he really worked for this knowledge, the Upayanishta, even for him to get Shravana, being handled as a pramana, that took years. Bhagavan gave that to him finally, you know. Who knows why? Maybe so because he was such a huge person. Maybe so that he would understand what it means to wield the pramana and what it means not to. Maybe that's why he went through all of that. We don't know. But all that he did, the seriousness with which he took Antakarana Shuddhi, he had plenty of painful events, very painful events that passed through his life, you know. How to get that type of depth that you can be, kind of like I see the Dalai Lama being. Swamiji is like that too. He's just open, and he just objectively deals and does the best he can and tries to help. And he doesn't run off spewing to other people. That's the end of it. It's a very tough situation. He handles it. He does everything that he can, you know. And then that situation is over until it comes back again. So that's the bigness, the saintliness, you know, that seems for us maybe a little bit out of grasp. But you know what? It isn't out of grasp. It just takes time. This isn't Vedanta and Karana Shuddhi are not like the Shaktipat. And we're all fine. It's that there's the unfolding in Ishwar's time of this flower of our hearts. It just unfolds at its own slow time, like watching a clock that itself is running slow. You know, watching a slow clock tick. But if you look back, you always see how much you've grown because you have. So these type of things are the hard things. No escape. Swamiji had them all. Even in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, all of the heroes and heroines, they go through the most awful things, really terribly, terribly difficult things. And they go through those, the reason that they're called these itihasas, like these, epics, these long epics. Swamiji's talked about this before. They always have these tremendous challenges, you know. But these are the stories because then you learn as a child and as you're growing up how your heroes and heroines handle these difficult life situations that come up. And they go into great detail. That's why I always suggest don't read one of these abridged versions of the Ramayana, the Mahabharata. Read the whole thing, even if it takes like, the Mahabharata is this big, it's like 18 volumes, but once you get into it, you know, just like for me, I like to read books or audio books that are long so I can be in that world. I don't want the world to come to the end if it's a good book. I like to be in there. Well, this is 18 volumes. So once you get into it and get used to all the Indian names and kind of the old English or some of the English translations, you know, it'd be nice to read it in Sanskrit, but it takes a lot of vocabulary. So if you just want to read a nice English translation. But you're in there for a long time, and you learn really a lot because of the very detailed relating of the stories. You know, it's very colorful, very rich, and you just find yourself living in there. But the kids learn so much. What happens is the grandmothers usually come, and, you know, and they spend all their time telling the kids these stories. Like one of my students, who has a boy, the boy's now like 18, he's getting ready to go to college, I guess he's 17. But I knew him when he was just a baby. And her mother, my student's mother, comes every year, and then once in a while they go back to India. And what does she do every night? She tells stories. That's what the grandmothers do. They tell stories of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. They have it all totally in detail in their mind, and they tell these stories. And all these stories are very exciting, and they catch your attention, and they all have these beautiful Dharma lessons in them. You know. So I read through them. I got completely engaged in these stories when I was first went to India. I was about 22 or 23. And I really love them. So I read them all the time in my free moments. I love to read them. And it's very, especially for women, it's for men too, it's big, I'd say for both, but for us, we're kind of deprived of heroines, you know. And to see to have goddesses and to have women who are strong and, you know, taking a stand and know what to do and these kind of things, feminine and competent. Not feminine and incompetent, feminine and confident, and, you know, respected, even the devatas, you know, respected, all of these things. It's very amazing. I was amazed because I was only amazed because we hadn't had that experience, and I was really affected by it in a beautiful way. But I think the men also, not in India because they already have all of this, but I think the Western men are also very affected by it because the men, the heroes, have the full scale continuum of emotion. kind of like in the Greek myths also, the men have the full access to all emotions. You know, not just rage and heroics, but also hurt and pain and crying and, you know, the whole spectrum, whatever it is, the whole spectrum is there, and they have that, it shows how they express that. So there's a much fuller expression. They have a much fuller expression that is culturally natural. When I was first in India, I was 22, and I went to the ashram, and once I got to the ashram is when I noticed this. There's a lot of guys, almost all young men, maybe in their 20s, were almost all the students. And they were all walking around holding hands. The men were, they're all holding hands, or they have their arms draped around each other, you know, all the time. And I was thinking, wow, are they all gay? I'd never seen anything like that. That type of love and warmth and hugging and, you know, like we women naturally do all of that, you know, but you don't usually see that type of physicality and warmth and love among men. Then I realized, oh, they're all like that. They're not afraid to, they don't have restrictions at all. So that's just how people are naturally when they don't have those restrictions, I thought. So nice. You have to be gay and out of the closet. If anybody's going to see one man touching another man, hugging another man, you know, walking, holding hands, mm-hmm. all the time. Oh, God. So, if one is aware at an unconscious, so if one is aware of an unconscious attraction pattern, can it be held? Can it be healed over time through inner child meditation or therapy? Or maybe to be friends with a person a long time before intimate, so you can see if you are in the same pattern or not. I think that these unconscious patterns can definitely be healed over time once you're aware of it. You know, once you're aware of the pattern, then even if there's not a partner there, or somebody that you're interested out here, you're still aware of that pattern. And there's probably there's an inner child pattern, an inner child need. Maybe you can even go back to the father or mother, whoever the sex is here. But as you do that type of work, the pattern itself starts to change, to evolve. You know, that's why I said the other day when we were doing about you, how you can watch your anima and animus actually change and mature. And so you'll start finding yourself being attracted to maybe somebody who is more compatible, that would be a better partner for you. So yes, I think that change, you might not get rid of things, some things completely, but you get control over them. There is a change that takes place, but also you have space to recognize that too. And so it's a lot easier to handle it when it comes up, rather than just finding yourself all of a sudden trapped in a relationship that then you discover, oh, this is the same pattern. So, but now more, you see. Yeah, therapy is good too. It depends on the type of therapy. You want to do the type of therapy that really works with the unconscious. It's called there's a lot of different kinds of depth therapy, as opposed to something like cognitive behavioral, which also has its use, but not so much in this case. Then it says, or maybe be friends with a person a long time before being intimate, so you can see if you are in the same pattern or not. That's kind of hard to do. You know, because you find yourself kind of in the relationship. It's something that's happening, you know. And so, of course, I know this is not very Swedish, and it's probably not very, Italian either. but you know, I actually feel that people sleep together physically way too soon, and they don't give enough time, you know, for that attraction and that kind of anticipatory, you know, wonder and all of that. They don't allow that very special intimacy. They don't allow themselves to, as a couple, to mature into that. And so it's almost like, well, to really be together, we have to sleep together on the first night. As though it's some kind of a sport or something. And actually, actually, it really isn't. There's a lot of things that happen, even in a chemistry-wise, when you sleep with somebody. And it creates it's like there's a deep opening that takes place even physiologically. And so you're both putting yourself in that position. It's a deep intimacy, and it shouldn't be just shared with anybody just because, you know, because you're going out together. But I think that maybe people are so far away from that now that they don't really, maybe they don't really, that maybe that doesn't even exist anymore because the system has shut down because of sleeping with everybody like on the first or second date or whatever. I don't know how it is for, I know that's very common in the States. I don't know how it is for all of you, but I feel like that there's a closure that takes place and a hardness that takes place, and it just becomes like a sport, something that we do, you know, and that it's expected. Women will think it's very much expected of them. If they don't do it, then the man will not ask them out again, especially with young people. So there's all this kind of stuff, and so everybody just succumbs to this. But what happens is, I think, is that there's it loses its sanctity, and there's a physiological closure that takes place just so that you can have this sport going on, you know, that's, I don't know. I think that it's so much in the culture that it's hard for people not to do that, but I think there's a lot that's being missed. You know. One union analyst who, he was my supervisor. We all, as we become therapists, we have different supervisors that we do report all our casework to and all of this. So I had him for, when I was studying at the Jung Institute, I had him for 6 months, I think 6 months or a year. So you present all your cases, and he was very good. But what he said, I don't know how this, I don't remember the situation, but I remember what he said. He said, women should be a little bit harder to get, you know. Make the man wait for a few months, you know. And then if they stick around long enough and want it badly enough, then when the time is right, you know. But don't be in such a hurry. They also like the chase. I understood what he meant too. They like the conquest, you know. And it's something to hold back and not be that easy to get, and have it be something that's deserved, that the relationship now is something that deserves that, and it's just not over and done with right away, and then you have nothing more to give. You've given everything, so, you know. Just some ideas. I don't know if we're way beyond that in the culture, our cultures now, or not, but I would think about it. Mm-hmm. I'm very old. But I still believe this, honestly. Please talk a bit more about what you mean by invoke the grace of Bhagawan, invoke your Ishtadevata, and invoke the grace of your Guru. Okay. Well, there's different ways to say it. If I think of Bhagawan, just say if I'm sitting in meditation, when I think of Bhagawan, I'm actually coming immediately into that relationship. So to me, that relationship is prayerful. So when I say invoke the grace of or invoke Bhagawan, you know, I invoking his presence, then that's actually happening. So whatever words you use, I just don't know what words to use. So if I'm talking kind of generically to all of you, how do you do that? If you just think of Bhagawan, you just bring yourself into relationship with Ishvara, that creates a very beautiful presence. It's the context in which you're doing this meditation, you know, because on the one hand, the self that is yourself is the self, which is Ishvara. So you're even in being with yourself, you're being with Ishvara. So that's a recognition. Also, you recognize that this body, mind, sense organs, all of your karmas, everything, is all Ishvara. There is, as what Swamiji says, every single vritti is Ishvara. How do I invoke Ishvara, Swamiji? Every vritti is Ishvara. How do I see Ishvara? How do I experience Ishvara? Every vritti is Ishvara. So we can understand that way, which is very beautiful, but also just recognizing your own prarabdha karma, you know, and that this world that you find yourself in, along with everybody, all living beings in it, all of it is Ishvara. There's nothing that's not Ishvara. And so when you invoke Ishvara's grace or Ishvara's presence, it's in a way it's invoking your knowledge. You know, there's gratitude for you. Just to be able to say that, to understand who Bhagawan is, there's so much gratitude in that. So you're invoking all of your knowledge, really, in invoking Ishvara. So invoke may be the wrong word. You have to figure out what your own way of doing that is. It could just be just the mere thought of Bhagawan, you know, whatever. But it's bringing that center into the center. And then the Ishtadevata. Ishtadevata is like taking the Ishvara and then having him in a form, because Bhagawan can take any form. He can be worshipped in any form. You know what Ishvara is. But maybe you like to take a walk with your Ishtadevata. Or maybe you like to, when things are hard, it's nice to invoke your Ishtadevata and just let your Ishtadevata be you. You know, in that situation, you just become with the Ishtadevata that embody you. And then you, as your Ishtadevata, then invoke that situation, whatever it is that's so painful, or it's not, you don't know how to handle it, or you don't have the patience to be with that complex situation, whatever. Then you see how she or he will handle that. And then that gives you a lot of support, because you have a wisdom figure in the form of your Ishtadevata who can walk with you, who will always be there, and you can, it just invokes, when you embody, let the Ishtadevata embody you. For me, like say if it's Jnaneshwari or Saraswati or whoever I may be invoking, I just look at her as an embodiment of Ishvara. You know, in that form, having to deal in the world with an upadhi like this. So how will she do it? Because she's embodying you, whatever the problem, your problems are, and the person's problem or the issue, whatever the issue is, that's all very known. But she brings in that absolute Ishvara drishti, that Ishvara's vision without any raga dvesha, or any complexes, complex-free, that helps. So having that invoking that presence in meditation tends to also take you even deeper into Ishvara. If it does, if it's not something real for you, then that doesn't really matter. These are just things to do if it helps. Then I don't know. When I say invoke your, I usually say invoke the sampradaya instead of invoking the presence of your guru, because you may or may not have a guru, you may have different teachers, all kinds of things, but you're learning, continuing to learn this, the sampradaya, you know, that goes all the way back to Ishwara, from guru sisha, guru sisha, guru sisha. Now this knowledge has arrived at you. And so that's a considered incredible punya to be part of that sampradaya, to have it landed here, you know, where you all are for several years now really gaining this knowledge and being blessed by it, and you're now part of the sampradaya because you're gaining so much knowledge you can yourself, you know, be teaching, which is a good thing. Teaching is the greatest way to nishta. You have to know something, you know, but then what you know you should teach. Find ways that it works for you with the level that you're at, if you can possibly do that. You know, even when we were giving the, you know, the 3-year courses, the students would always get together with each other and explain things to each other. In a real way also. And we really always, Swamiji always encouraged that too. Because it's good to explain. You know? Somebody asks you a question and you're not sure, you can always say something like, I'm not sure, but let me try to explain it. You know? Just so you get that chance. You know? Or maybe you're clear on it and then you can explain it. Don't ever be afraid to say, I don't know. It gives you so much freedom. If you don't have that ego involvement, that it just know it's okay to not know something, you'll find out. Because then you don't have to feel like you're always being put on the spot. Because you don't want to feel awkward saying, I don't know. So you're supposed to know everything. Nobody knows everything, you know. So that gives you tremendous freedom to really be able to talk about this knowledge and explain it to the best of your ability if somebody wants to know. It's very, very good for your own understanding. And Bhagavan gives a lot. When you try to bring it out to somebody who needs to know something, it's like Bhagavan, you know, really comes to the rescue and gives you much more than you can even believe. You think, oh, did I have all of that inside of me? Probably not. But you tap into like this ocean of knowledge that comes through as a great blessing for the student and for the teacher. So that's why I do that. I also think for ourselves as we're teaching that we're held within that sampradaya, and that the sampradaya for Swamiji was so important. His whole life, really. I look at him as another Shankara that needs to come every now and then. His whole purpose was to reestablish that sampradaya, which he did. And even because he had so many, he taught so many people and he taught them so thoroughly, you know. And it's not that everybody went out and became a teacher, but he taught so many people that many of those people did. And they're planted all over India, you know. And a few are in the other, you know, like in Japan also, in the States, some, you know, different places around Brazil, all over, really. And these are people who have really been taught and who are really, really committed. And that means these little light, these little sampradaya lights are, and it's been reestablished. And then this aim for seva, that gave... We didn't quite know what is going on. Astrology went into all of that. But actually, it was giving strength to the culture itself that holds this. You know, he established so many temples, and these in the south, these huge temples that are on wheels. It's an ancient tradition. Big, huge temples on wheels, and that are pulled by elephants and by humans, like 1,000 people and elephants pulling it. You know, from one village to the next. He had like 14 of these built. And just, he did all kinds of things to establish the tradition and to help people become self-supporting so that they could keep in their tradition and were not being bought off by the Muslims or Christians who try to give you enough money and enough medical care and everything. If you convert, you know, there's a lot of that. So he was so engaged in trying to save the people so that they could keep their own religion, a lot of tribal religions also, you know, without being in a position where they had no food, they had no medical care, they had no sanitation, nothing. And so they were vulnerable to being converted just so they could have something. So anyway, he did so much work, more than, you can't even imagine how many little kids he's educated through this Aim for Save, and how many people around India has chipped in. I think it's made a huge difference, even though there's all of this stuff going on. Still, there's a big enough group to not go into extinction. Yeah. To stop the extinction process. Ugh, awful. Okay, let me see. So anyway, we're part of that sampradaya. Oh, well, I'll say this a little differently, though this is fine. Could you explain what you meant by every thought is like a puja because it is Brahman? You can say that because it is Brahman, or you can say that the thought itself is Ishwar, because if you're thinking of the thought, you're thinking of kind of the Maya Upadi, right? The thought is Mithya. But then Ishwar also is Mithya, and Mithya has no being whatsoever apart from Brahman. You know, it's like the clay pot. There's really only clay there, and here there's really only Brahman here. But when we're talking about every thought is Ishwara, then every thought is like a puja, right? Because it's Ishwara, you know? What's your relationship with Ishwara is one of what we call Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. There's a worshipful relationship to it, to Ishwara. If we're people who do puja or do manasa puja, means you do mentally do puja, it's just attitudinal, you know? And then if you think every thought is Ishwara, then every person is Ishwara. Every contact, every experience you have is Ishwara. Every animal is Ishwara. Yeah. There's nothing that's not Ishwara. And so when one of the wonderful things about the beautiful pujas that you all do is it just invokes that and can help you go through the day. You invoke it in such a beautiful way in the morning, and it can take you through the whole day, you know. It's also, with a manasa puja, it means it's something that comes to your mind, that puja comes to your mind in reference to your experiences, and especially the hard experiences, where you could just, your little jiva head can pop right up and respond accordingly to whatever the raga dvesha is, you know. So how to be with that, be with this antakarana shuddhi. That's why it's good to do puja, it's good to do meditation, it's good to keep yourself in a protected environment until you don't need that. We need it for a long time. Yeah. Which is fine. What else do we have to do? Okay, I don't have time to do this well.
Purnasya purnamadaya purnamevavashyate.
Shyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.